Hello, welcome to Woodbridge Library. Thank you very much for coming this afternoon. This is an event organised by Browsers Bookshop, and I'm Catherine Larne, and I'm very pleased to be introducing Martin Walker here today. We're going to be chatting together for about 40 minutes, and then there'll be the opportunity for questions, and then Martin will be available to sign your books. And you're correct. Very loud on your microphone. I can hear you breathing.
I can hear myself breathing.
Right, well, we'll kick off anyway.
Okay. Do you need a testing level or?
Is everyone happy with that?
Yes. You all hear me at the back?
Jolly good. Okay. Well, we're obviously all very pleased to have you here today. Thank you very much for joining us in Woodbridge on your tour of Britain, a little tour of Britain, because yes, you've got all sorts of other things planned. So what other tours have you got lined up for this particular book coming up?
Well, I did a US tour in June when it came out, and I'm off for the whole of October on a Europe tour of Germany, Switzerland, Austria, and a stop in Milan and a stop in Prague, because it's in Italian and in Czech. And then I'm off to the States for another wee tour. These days it's marketing, and you have to do an awful lot of it, so how I get time to write the things.
And getting about a bit as well. I mean, you've got homes in France and America, which we know about through reading about you. So how do you find the time for all these things and fitting it all in, working out where you are each time?
Well, it's the real problem about having we've got a place in Washington, because when I was a correspondent there for The Guardian, I was there for many years, and then I was working there in other capacities, and our kids went to school there. So we've got so many friends there in Washington that we thought it made sense to keep the place on. And the confusing thing is you never know where your clothes are or where the particular kind of clothes are, and that's a bore. But no, it's one of the reasons I became a foreign correspondent was that I'm a restless kind of person, and I love the idea of transforming my life or changing my life every few years, and there's no better way of doing that than being a foreign correspondent. Going from spending time in Africa, and then 4 years in Moscow, and then 10 years in Washington, it's great. And then France as well. So it's like you adopt new personalities every time, and I really, really enjoy that. I guess it's my parents, my family is from Barra, one of these West Coast islands, off the west coast of Scotland, and my mother has always assured me that our ancestors are all Vikings, so that's why we've got the travel bug and all like to potter around. But we don't go burning churches and slaughtering and pillaging. We've sort of learned a bit better than that now.
So you spent time in Moscow and also in Washington. So at what point did you decide that you needed to make a home in France?
When my wife, Julia, my wife said to me that we should do so, what had happened was that back in the 70s, I'd been in the Lebanon during covering the civil wars there, and it was one of those times when you didn't want to work alone because there were some hostages being taken and so on. So I worked with a French colleague, and we became great friends, and he and I met our wives in the same year, and our first children were born in the same year. And then he and his wife Gabrielle inherited a place in the Périgord from her grandfather, and they decided to move there and raise their children in the countryside. So we would often go and visit them. And when we were in Moscow, because it was Gorbachev time and perestroika, and it was a wonderful time to be a journalist, but the food was unspeakable. And so the opportunity to be in the Périgord and be eating foie gras and truffles and roast duck and so on was just too good to be true. And then I was actually in the... Julia and our children, our daughters, were staying with our friends in the Périgord. And I was over in Washington because I had an interview set up with Bill Clinton. And I was actually in the anteroom to the Oval Office when my very primitive early cell phone rang, and it was Julia. I don't care what you're doing, get the next plane back to France, I have found our house. Now, at this point, I wasn't altogether clear we were looking for a house. But since we've now been married for 41 years, and the basic rule of the marriage is Julia is always right. So I said, well, Clinton, interview. But about 3 days later, I was on a plane back to France, and Julia was right. She had found our house, and this was, 21 years ago. It's a lovely place. It was a bit of a ruin, but we had great fun putting it together. And we were just very lucky in, first of all, we had some friends there, but then we made a lot of local friends through the local tennis club and the rugby club and the hunting club. And so we just feel sort of embraced by the local community. There was, when my elder daughter, Kate, when she was a late teenager, she went through a goth phase. Do you know what I mean? The face all white and sort of a walking ironmongery hanging around her ears and things. And she had some of her friends come and stay. They were also goths and heavy boots and so on. And I heard them plotting one evening as they were drinking late all night by the pool, that they were going to go to the market the next morning and really show these backward French people what the modern, trendy Brits were all about. And so Julia and I went down to the cafe by the bridge to watch this scene. And there were Kate and her three friends, all of them in black with white faces, clank, clank from the facial metal and so on. And they were walking across the bridge, all wearing these bobber boots, so it was clunk, 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 clunk. And at the end of the bridge was standing my dear friend and tennis partner, Piero, our village policeman, who gave me the idea for Bruno in the first place. And Piero was standing there with his arms crossed, and clank, 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 as they walked. And I felt like whistling that tune from a Clint Eastwood movie, you know. Do, 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 do. This sort of Mexican standoff getting closer. Clank, clank, clank. Piero standing there, and when Kate gets to within about 1 yard of him, Piero just throws his arms up and says, "Kate!" and gives her a great big hug. And I've never seen sort of goths droop so much. But that's the kind of mood in that place. It's a lovely welcoming village. And this year we are celebrating the 700th anniversary on our weekly market every Tuesday. It's a lovely little place. I'm very fond of it.
So lots of lovely local produce to buy, and also you grow a lot, and, well, animals as well. Do you have animals?
I do. We have our own chickens and pheasants, and with a neighbour I share ducks and geese, and the neighbour also has goats to make goat's cheese. We live on our garden. I'm always back there in March and April to get the garden sorted, the vegetable garden sorted for the summer. We live on our garden most of the summer. And when we started getting chickens, when Sarkozy was the French president, was his very last few months in office, so we got a cockerel. And we named him Sarko for Sarkozy. And he came with four wives, I guess, four hens. There was the prettiest one, we called her Carla Bruni, which was the name of Socrates' wife. And the second one never stopped talking and running around, highly energetic. That was Hillary Clinton. And the third one was the real tyrant, always the first to be eating the other hen. Pow, pow, Margaret Thatcher. And the fourth one we called Angela Merkel, and she gives the most eggs. What kind of anyway, they're now sort of, there's rather more of them now, but it's great fun having chickens. And I've got these wonderful neighbours who look after them when I'm off on my travels, and look after my dog, the Basset Hound. We've always had Basset Hounds, as you can sort of imagine. So, and we grow most things. I mean, we grow, of course, tomatoes, courgette, potatoes, garlic, onions, leeks, haricot beans, strawberries, apples, pears, apricots, peaches, you name it. It's a lovely, fertile part of France. I mean, it really is sort of the garden of France in a way. And so we eat jolly well, I think. And we've got a primitive kind of communism. I mean, anybody who is growing vegetables, you know, you will always get too many tomatoes at a certain time, and too many courgettes at a certain time. So we just give them away. I often get many more eggs than we can do with. So we just give them away to neighbours and friends. And in return, you know, the hunt club will come and drop off a shoulder of venison, or chaps will come back from the river and there'll be four fresh trout for us. So, it's wonderful.
And wine as well. Don't share the wine with them.
We share an awful lot of wine. we've got an English language newspaper in the Périgord, which is called The Bugle. And so I now write a regular column about wine, which gives me an opportunity to go around all the vineyards. They have a system in the Bergerac that dates back to 1254, when the English were running the place. And the English king of the day, Edward II, wanted, because he liked the red wine from southwestern France, because he owned most of the area anyway, and he wanted the wines of Bergerac to be able to come through Bordeaux without paying extra taxes. So he set out a charter giving Bergerac wine the right to do that, which is still in force. And he set up the Grand Consulate of the Wine of Bergerac. And every year, throughout, there's always been 20 grand consuls. And I'm the first Scotsman to be a grand consul in these 1200, since 1254. Mm-hmm. And it gives me the right to go into any vineyard in the Bergerac and taste things for quality control. I mean, is this lucky or what? So, one of the things about the French, I mean, they've got their own little ways, and when you get to know it, they're really quite endearing. And one of them is they love to dress up. They really do. And the other thing they adore is communal meals. And they found a way to combine this. They set up these confrérie brotherhoods to support various kinds of foodstuffs. So we have this Grand Consulate of the Wines of Bergerac. Well, we've got our medieval robes and medieval bonnets. And every once in a while, we will all get together, the Grand Consuls, and we'll put our medieval robes on, and we'll have a very long lunch in the cellars of the Maison des Vins in Bergerac. And we will be tasting and testing and serving all the wines. So, for example, when we have to decide which of our wines of Bergerac are going to go up to Paris for the big concours, the big contest for winning gold medals and so on, we do a blind tasting. So we get all the wines that are nominated, and we wrap them in black sacks so you can't see which ones they are. And then we have to blind taste them to see which ones we think are good enough to go up for the prizes. And we all have to get dressed up for that. And then we've got another one, which is for foie gras, which is this wonderful, you know, fat liver from ducks and geese. We've got another confrérie for that, so I'm a chevalier of that as well, with an entirely different set of robes. And again, it's an excuse to get together and have these communal meals, and we justify it by doing tests for the best foie gras of the year and so on. It's wonderful, but I mean, I really thank God I've got my dog to work some of this weight off.
Well, yes, and it's a wonder you find time to write the books. So let's talk about the books. How did you come to write about Bruno in the first place? You said that he was inspired by one of the people in the village, but how did you decide you wanted to write fiction?
Well, the novel that I first wrote about the Périgord was just when we got the place in the Périgord. I became fascinated with the caves, because one of the things about this area is that most of what we know about prehistoric people comes from this valley, the Vézère Valley. So you've probably all heard of the Lascaux Cave, which is like the Sistine Chapel of prehistoric people. So it's a most spectacular, wonderful place. And we've got over 20 of these painted, decorated caves in there, and some of them are just wonderful. Picasso was one of the first people, about number 12 or 13, to visit the Lascaux Cave when it was rediscovered in 1940. And he came out and said, "We have learned nothing in all these thousands of years. I mean, we have met our masters here." And Lascaux was painted about 1900 years ago. And I was so enthralled, I went round cave after cave after cave. I went interviewing archaeologists at the National Museum of Prehistory. And I wrote a novel called The Caves of Perigord, which was all about what kind of society might have produced this masterwork. And I was still so fascinated with the area that I wanted to carry on. And every Friday morning I was going down to our local tennis club for a chaps, a very relaxed doubles game. And there was the Baron, who was a neighbour of mine, and Pierrot, the policeman, and then Yannick, who was a local train driver, and they always had their days off on a Friday, and so we'd all meet on a Friday morning. We'd play a couple of hours of very relaxed tennis, often with an open bottle of wine down beside the net, and then we'd go off to the tennis club. Now, this being France, the tennis club, I mean, we're a town of fewer than 2,000 people. We've got three courts and a covered court, and a wonderful dining room about this size, and a kitchen almost as big. And so we would prepare our own lunch, and I would bring along wine or whiskey or whatever, or cheese, and Piero would bring along eggs from his garden and truffles. The Baron would be providing steaks, and we'd have a lunch that would go on till about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But we thought it was justified, because we'd been playing a bit of tennis. And I thought, this fellow, Piero, he'd been 10 years in the French army. He spent all of his spare time teaching the local children to play tennis or rugby. He knew everybody, not just in the village, but in the whole commune around it, in several other communes. Of course, he was a member of all of the hunting clubs and the rugby club and the tennis club. And he buried most of the grandparents, and he'd held the baby at many christenings, and he danced with the bride at all of the weddings. He knew everybody. I thought, I've got to write about a character like this. So that was the inspiration for the whole of the Bruno. And then most of the local history, which is so rich and full, comes into the novels as well. And then there's all the food. I mean, I never lack for inspiration.
So what does Piero think of the fact that he is a central character for these very successful series of books?
Well, he's just taken his retirement. But for the last few years, he has been sort of enjoying his role as a tourist icon. Because we would get tourists coming into the town on market day, and they'd be bringing their books in English or in German or in Swedish or in whatever, in Turkish, and they would be sort of, they'd come into the market and they'd be looking around for a policeman. And they would say, in various forms of French, "Et vous, Bruno?" And he'd ask me for a few words in various languages. So if he was asked in English, he would say, "Yes, I am." And in German, "Jawohl." And he would take the book and he would sign it. And then he'd stand for selfies with you. So he loved this role and so on. I must say, when the books first began to come out in French, I was a bit nervous. And always when a new book would come out, Julia, my wife, and I would have a dinner party for various friends. So Pierrot, the policeman, and his wife would be there, and the Baron and his wife, and the mayor and his wife would be there. And I would, and after the first course, I'd tap the glass and say, "Well, dear friends, there's a new Bruno book coming out in England now. We ought to celebrate it. And it's in this book, I write about the beauty of the women of the Perigord and the intelligence of the men." yeah, Martin, we said yes. More wine. Okay. But when the first one came out, I thought, am I going to have to go into exile after this? You know, I mean, when they sort of read about what I really think about this place. But no, they just said, "More wine, Martin, more wine." It was fine. Wine solves many, many problems.
So your friends and neighbours, they're not worried about being featuring in the book?
Oh no, they're dying to be on TV with it. I remember when we had a TV crew from Germany that came by, and we're doing a programme about, you know, me and the Perigord, and the next morning, and it just filled me in the market, so next morning, I was sitting having my coffee and croissant down in the main cafe, and these three battle axes come up to me. They're women of a certain size, a certain kind of power, and they stood before, they wanted to be folding their arms beneath their most imposing bosoms, and said, "Martin, next time that you have TV cameras coming to Le Bugue, you must give us at least a week of notice." And I said, "But of course, madame, but why?" "So we can go to the coiffeur for our So they also seemed to like it.
And it was, the series of books, they're hugely successful all over the place. When did it first kick off, if you like, as to how successful it was, and in so many different languages?
Well, it took off really because of Julia, my wife, because she was the one who said, I mean, when I wrote the first draft of the first one, she said, you need an international name, because you might be able to sell this book elsewhere. So why not something that works in different languages, like Bruno? That was Julia. And then when she finished it, she said, you know, you've got something here, but publishers like the idea of a series. So go away and write 5 short paragraphs on each of the next 5 novels in your series. Julia is always right, remember?
Yes.
So that's what worked. And within about 3 months, we'd sold it in many countries. And it's now in 18 languages. So.
Good.
Japanese, Turkish.
And on these tours, you go around and speak in a few languages, not Japanese, though, perhaps.
Not Japanese. But yes, I go and I speak. I mean, my German isn't great, but I get by in German and, of course, in French. And I sort of stumble through a bit of Italian. The Czech is a bit beyond me. The Polish I can sort of get by with my Russian. So, it's wonderful how people all around the world seem to have this romantic view of France. And this sort of sense of France as a place that really has a savoir-vivre. I mean, they know how to live. And it's true. And I just write about what I live and what I see. You know, it's a documentary with occasional crime. And it's a bit of a challenge, because when I potter around the area, I always have to keep an eye on where I can put a corpse. You can't write a crime story about having a corpse. So this one, the body in the castle well, just down the road from my house is this glorious hilltop village called Limeuil. And there's been a fortress there since before Julius Caesar, because in his De Bello Gallico, about the Gallic Wars, this slightly tells how his legions stormed the place. It was a hilltop fort of the Gauls. He built a Roman oppidum there. Then Charlemagne had a fort there against the Vikings. And then in the Hundred Years' War, it built a castle with several walls, and it changed hands several times. And in the middle of it, the very top of the hill, is this huge old well. And the moment I saw that, I thought, going to have a body in there. It's like this other glorious chateau of Comarque, which has got a great big high, it's on top of a very high cliff, and then this one very high wall of a high tower on top. I thought, I've got to have a body coming down. It's really a sort of a trigger to your imagination to try and find credible places for the dead. It's, the other thing about Limeuil, which is great, is that it's where the two rivers come together, the Vézère and the Dordogne. So that's why it was so important, because it was a key treaty point, because most of the transport was done by river in the old days. Roads were just awful. And so it was quite an important port, which meant the thing about having castles, you had to have taxes that would pay for the soldiers and the garrisons that were going to be there. And since we had so many castles in the Périgord, we had an awful lot of taxes, which is why we hold the French all-comers record for peasant revolts in this part of the world. But the extraordinary thing about Limeuil is that some years ago, the archaeologists came across something really strange. a cache of several hundred, about 800 stones, each of them small flat stones about the size of this book, and on each of them was engraved one of four different animals, either a mammoth or a bull or a horse or an eagle. And they were almost identical, but not quite. Some of the legs had been scraped out and redrawn, the tail had been redone. And the only explanation the archaeologists could come up with was that this had been the world's first art school, mm-hmm. where people were learning how to do this 12,500 years ago. I walk off in the other direction, another short walk from my house, and I come to a cliff which has got a, clearly got a big sort of indentation in it, a rock shelter, about 50 yards long. And it's just covered in green grill at the moment. It's called La Ferrassie, but it's one of the most important archaeological sites that we know. It's the first time, it's the oldest grave cemetery in Europe, possibly in the world. It's the first time we know that human beings buried one another with ritual and respect, with flowers spread around the heads of the dead, some of the bodies covered with big flat stones with various carvings and indentations on them. We don't know what it meant, but we know it must have meant something to them. And it was a way of respect, I guess. And there were eight bodies buried there. And one of them, a man in his 40s, had got some terrible kind of arthritis, rotting disease. He couldn't have walked for at least 5 or 6 years, let alone go hunting. So they must have fed him and taken care of him, which is to say, this was a community. There was a degree of human solidarity here. And so the idea of the first burials with real formality and also the first human community taking care of one another, it's 72,000 years old. It's Neanderthals. It's not even Homo sapiens. It's Homo sapiens Neanderthalis. And it's just a walk from where I am. And we've got more history than we know what to do with it. So. But it's really, I'm just awed by this stuff. I really am rocked by it.
It's a huge inspiration in the area. Mm. But you do have to do a certain amount of research and planning for your books and fitting it in amongst your travel and all your other commitments as well. What is your writing regime then? How do you commit to writing the books each year?
Once I start to write, I have a rule that I have to produce at least 1,000 words a day, no matter what else I'm doing. If I'm on a plane, I have to do it on a plane. If I'm on a train, I have to do it. And it's the only way I can discipline myself. And some days I write a lot more. And some days I know that some of those 1,000 words I've written, I will in the end probably reject or put them to another book or something. But I spent quite a lot of time planning out, plotting out the book and getting a broad idea of the main plot and where it's going. But first of all, it's because most of my life I was a journalist on a daily paper, and so was accustomed to writing every day. That wasn't the problem. But then I read in a collection of Hemingway's letters, he was writing to Scott Fitzgerald, who was complaining he had a bit of a writer's block. And Hemingway said, well, do what I do. He said, I produce 300 words a day. And if that's all you have to do, it doesn't take that long. And the big secret, Hemingway went on, is never stop at the end of a chapter. Never stop at the end of a paragraph. Stop in the middle of a sentence, because it's so much easier to start again the next day. And I followed this advice faithfully. It's very good advice.
They're plotting ahead, but what about Bruno? Have you decided what's going to happen to him? Or is it just
he
a book
hasn't
at
really
time?
Told me yet. And besides, Bruno has the capacity to surprise me. There was one novel, The Devil's Cave, where I introduced a femme fatale figure, a rather dangerously attractive but menacing woman. And in my scheme of things, Bruno is only a guy. She was going to seduce him for her own nefarious purposes, and Bruno succumbs to her wiles. But as I began to write this chapter, there's like a force field beginning to come out of my desk. I am not going to drop my trousers. And I thought, whatever, I thought, great, he's got a life of his own. But then I thought, oh Christ, I'm going to have to rewrite the whole of the ending. So yes, he does surprise me, so I don't really know. But I've got some broad outlines of, you know, where he's going next, and the book for next year is already done, it comes out next year. And I've just plotted out the book that will come out in 2021, which I'm writing. And I've got an idea for the book for 2021. So he, Bruno will write again. Or Hector, with Balzac at his side. And more fascinating French food will be on the way.
Well, yes, because that's something that we haven't mentioned about the descriptions of the meals in the books, because they are almost as good as recipes, aren't they? And so important to the reader. Was that right from the very beginning that you wanted to make that such an integral part of the book?
Well, it is an integral part of life in the Périgord, and equally of my life. I mean, I eat three times a day. Most people do. I probably spend more time eating and thinking about food and preparing food than I do anything else apart from actually writing. And it's always been baffled me that so many novels, people seem to live on thin air. They never go to sleep, they never eat, they never think about what they're eating, they never do any washing up. They don't go and collect their vegetables from their garden and so on. And that's how it is in the Périgord. So I wanted to write a bit about that, and I enjoy it so much. And I'm very lucky in Julia, my wife, who's a terrific cook. And Julia used to write about food for the Washington Post and Gourmet magazine in the States, so I'm lucky to have a real expert on call. And every recipe that comes into a Bruno, I have cooked myself, but usually with Julia on my shoulder saying, not so much salt, not so much of that garlic that you like so much, and so on and so forth. And aren't you going to put that pastry in the fridge to cool and set for a while? Yes, dear. Julia was always right.
And you wrote a cookbook together?
We did, yes, the first Bruno cookbook, it came out in Germany. For some reason the Germans are my biggest market. Well, you know, they love France, they've invaded it often enough. It was my publisher said, look, we've had an awful lot of letters from readers saying, when are we going to get a Bruno cookbook? So Julia did most of the work, Julia did put most of the recipes together, and I wrote the twiddly bits in between. And we were very lucky in that my German publishers got a real star photographer, a guy who just won the Europa Prize for food photography, a guy called Klaus Einweger, who came and stayed with us for a week during the photography. And he arrived on the weekend of our local Hunt Club festival, which meant that when he arrived, I was out there roasting wild boar, whole wild boar. We had three of them that we were roasting for the feast. And he took a lot of photographs of that, and of the hunters, and we organised it in an interesting way. We organised it around the people who produce the food. So there was a section on the le ramasseur, the people who go out and collect food, like the truffles and the mushrooms in the woods, and the maraîcher, the market gardener, the person who grows the vegetables, the butcher, the hunter, the fisherman, the baker. And so we've organised the book around these particular people with quite a few photographs of these people in local markets and trying to put faces to it all. It was a big success in Germany, I got this invitation to go out to China because Gourmand International is an organization that awards every year the prize for the world's best restaurant and the world's best chef. And I was overwhelmed to find that we were the world's best French cookbook. which was a real shock to the French, I can tell you. They haven't quite recovered yet. So I said to my American publisher, I said, well, look, it's just got this prize. Why aren't you going to fill it out in the USA? He said, Martin, he said, for a cookbook to succeed in the US, you need two of three things, and preferably three of these things. You need a world-class restaurant, you need your own TV show, and you need a figure like Nigella Lawson. I didn't use the word figure, I'm bad at that. And I said, well, I don't qualify on any one of those counts. He said, you see? So we're in negotiations now, and I think it might be coming out in the USA, and I do hope so. Anyway, we're doing another one that comes out in October in German. We're launching it at the Frankfurt Book Fair next month. It's called Bruno's Garden Cookbook, and it's lots of stuff about the gardens. In fact, what I must do is, is there a website for the library?
Yes, and the bookshop.
Okay, well, we made a video, Julia and I, of this book in English, about this book, so I can send a copy of that to you, and you can sort of make it available to the library for people. And it's, it shows that our garden of picking stuff up and the cooking, and I make a ta-ta-ta, and because it turns out so well, I go, yaha! And Julia's got flames coming out of a flambé and stuff. It's really quite fun. Yeah.
But what about a televised version of Bruno, the story of Bruno?
Well, it's the big German UFA Studios has bought the rights, and they are in production, as they say, and they've got a deal with Arte of France to make a French version, and I think there are discussions going on about an English one as well. Fingers are crossed.
Mm-hmm. Excellent.
However, the only thing that I've got special in that is, have you ever heard of the Hitchcock Clause? Mm-hmm. A friend of mine in Hollywood said, you must get the Hitchcock Clause. And the Hitchcock Clause says that in every single episode, the author gets a walk-on part. Because Hitchcock was this fat guy. Yeah. So I'll be reading a paper in the cafe, or walking in the back of the market, trying not to wave.
Yes. Okay, right, I've asked lots of questions. Has anybody got their questions that they'd like to ask Martin?
Is the book in English as well?
Not yet. We're hoping to get that done. That's one of the challenges. It's an odd thing that, you know, that the book was done so well in Germany that they were the ones who particularly wanted it. But now it's past a certain level in the States as well. I think that's where the next. And once it's in America, then of course we can bring it across. But it's modern publishing is interesting in its diversity.
I'm actually here by proxy, really. It's my wife's a great fan.
That's right.
And her sister, oldest sister, is a great fan. And her oldest sister lives in La Roque-Guijac.
Oh, right. Beautiful place.
From where you are.
Yeah. So you must have visited them there.
I have. And the reason I'm asking the question is that our favourite restaurant is La Belle Etoile.
Oh, beautiful restaurant.
And they asked me to ask you whether you would find a corpse there.
One of my favourite restaurants, Le Biologie at Travella, has also asked me if I could. And I think the Belle Etoile has got this glorious sort of, it's La Roque-Guijac is one of the prettiest villages in France. It's on this bend of the Dordogne, and it just climbs up this glorious honey-coloured cliff, and the cliff must be 500 feet high, and this village is stretched along the curve of the river and then clambers up this cliff, and it's got a microclimate of its own. So it's like a tropical garden on this cliff as well. And it's absolutely beautiful, it really is. But it's hell to get through in summer when the tourists are on a very narrow road and so on. But it's the Belle Etoile is a super restaurant, it really is. So I can't, of course, put it in the kitchens. Health and safety wouldn't go.
So the Bruno effect is quite considerable. What is the impact of tourism in the area since the books?
Well, the French government last year gave me a gold medal for services to tourism. they tried to work it out. They worked out that the Germans, before Bruno became a bestseller there, the Germans would be about number 8 in nationalities of visitors. They're now equal second. Mm-hmm. And they reckon that's about 50,000 German visitors a year now, and rising steadily. Yeah. And then other countries as well. So we're now getting Japanese and Koreans coming in. And,
it's not changing the feel of the place.
No, not really. I mean, it's one of the largest. It is the largest département in France, so it's big, and it's not very heavily populated. It's about, the Dordogne is about the size of the whole of East Anglia and southern England up to Devon. Mm-hmm. And the population is under 600,000. Mm-hmm. So there's quite a bit of room left over. And it's, and increasingly there's, you know, for a time we were having a real problem because of the way in which European farm policy was trying to reduce the numbers of small peasant farmers to go for these big ranch-like farms. But now people have adapted and we have a lot of tourism on the farm. So as well as having your small farm growing crops and veal and so on, you now also have, you can rent rooms and stay there and eat at the farmer's table. So that's become very popular. Mm. So when I first arrived in the Périgord, the biggest industry was farming, followed by wood, and now the biggest industry is tourism.
Yes.
So, come along. Thank you.
At the back, sorry.
Yeah. Was the Périgord Vichy during the Second World War, or was it occupied? Was it part of Vichy France?
It was part of Vichy, but it was also perhaps the central place in France for the resistance.
Yeah.
And the reason for that was that the Germans had a particular unit, the SS Panzer Division Das Reich, stationed near Toulouse. And it was where it had been refitted and re-equipped with Panther and Mark IV tanks. And it was the strongest single armoured unit the Germans had in the whole of Western Europe. And it accounted for about 10% of all of Germany's armoured strength in Western Europe. And the D-Day planners were really very worried about this, and they reckoned that if that reached the Normandy beaches within 3 to 4 days, which is what normally it would do, then there could be a massive armoured punch that could be a real problem for D-Day when people were still coming ashore. And since the Dordogne was the area just outside the range of the Royal Air Force fighter bombers, they wanted to try and use the resistance to slow down this particular unit as it was coming across the bridges of the Dordogne and the Vézère. And they mounted a huge operation with British and American commandos going in and helping the resistance and taking out German fuel supplies, sabotaging the rail cars, and the resistance trying to hold the bridges with very light weapons and so on. And it took 3 weeks for that division to reach Normandy, and every single day was bought with a lot of French blood of these resistance people. So, you know, when I hear Americans sometimes sneering about the French in World War II, I remind them of two things. One was that of this particular battle of resistance fought when they were holding bridges for an entire day against an armoured division. I mean, imagine that. And the other thing is that in the course of World War II, more French civilians died because of Allied bombing than British civilians died of bombing in the whole of World War II. The French paid a heavy price. And one reason why it took a while for them to organise was that they had 1.5 million of their own boys in German prisoner of war camps, captured in 1940. In effect, 1.5 million hostages for good behaviour. tough. Mm-hmm.
Can I ask how much input you have to the cover that goes on the books?
Mm-hmm. How much?
How much control or impact?
Zero. Mm-hmm. Zero. I mean, I think I'm lucky in my publishers in Britain, Quercus, and in the States, Knopf. Because I think this is a very nice, this just says France on it. Or some of them are your tables, and it says French food. I don't have the kind of visual imagination, I think, that would be good at picking out covers.
Julia might be.
She runs quite enough of my life. No, I'm joking. I'm a very lucky man. 41 years. You can do 4 murders for that. You know?
Another question, quick.
Hello.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm just want to thank you for resisting the temptation putting Bruno in the U.S. We've got enough corpses over there. So.
Well,
I don't know what your plans are for Bruno, but I liked keeping him in France.
Oh, he's not going to the U.S., but he's very popular over there.
Oh, yeah, no, I know.
But no, I'm not... You can't take Bruno out of the Perrin.
No.
I mean, I might do a short story and take him to Edinburgh for a rugby match, France versus Scotland. Or I might take him up to Paris for the tennis championships, Roland Garros or something, but that would be it. No, I can't take him out of the Périgord. He'd be lost. That's where it is from.
Anybody else?
Well, shall I give them a little flavour of...
Yes, do.
Have you all read Bruno?
Yes. All of them.
Oh wow! Wow! Oh, I better not try and read something from the new one then. But what I can say is that Bruno has changed my life in ways that I could never ever have imagined. Not just in the amount of travelling and promotion and marketing I'm doing, but it's opened so many doors for me in France. So it's made friends all over the Périgord region and in Bordeaux, and it's got me into these confreries, these dress-up things. Now, one of the things about the Dordogne, about the Périgord, is in the very first version of La Morte d'Arthur, the King Arthur and the Knights of the Round Table stories. There is a mention of the Périgord because it is the land of milk and honey that Sir Lancelot gives to his son, the pure Sir Galahad. And that's pretty much how I feel about the place, the land of milk and honey. As well as having our famous walnuts, our famous foie gras and our famous truffles, we're also the only place in the world with an appellation contrôlée for our walnuts. And we cook with them quite a lot. In fact, I think I mentioned in one of the books that when I do a barbecue, I always start up with one of these big sep mushrooms, rather like a porcini, into which I put it on top of the barbecue very quickly, and I put into it a cabicu, a round flat goat's cheese. And as the cabicu starts to melt, I drizzle honey over the top and then sprinkle some broken walnuts onto it. Makes a perfect starter for a and then the other thing about walnuts is every June, in the first few days of June, I make vin de noix, walnut wine, which is so easy to do. You go out before the middle of June and you cut the green walnuts, chop them up into quarters, so they're all white inside. You put them into a big deep pan with a lid on, and you put them in there with 8 litres of either red wine or white wine, according to taste. Then you have to work out how to get your litre of eau de vie. And the stuff I get is not quite legal. If you're having real trouble, give me a call. And on top of the litre of eau de vie, you pour in, the French pour in a whole kilo of sugar. I pour in 0.5 kilo, it's quite quick. You stir it, cover it, dark corner for about 8 weeks, and then you filter it, bottle it, and it keeps for years. I'm still drinking my 2002, and it's terrific. It tastes like Madeira. And when I cook, I've always liked beef bourguignon, but it's just beef stewed in Burgundy wine. I thought, well, why not try it in Bergerac wine, Bergerac red wine? So I tried that. I thought, well, it's pretty good, but we can do something extra. So I now add a glass of my own homemade Vin de Noir. Oh, it gives it just that little extra thing. It's a bit like, imagine if you're adding a glass of Madeira to a beef stew. It just gives it a little hint of something extra, which makes all the difference. So, and then on top of that, we have our strawberries. Again, as well as being walnuts, we're the only place in the world with our own Appellation Contrôlée for our strawberries of Périgord, in Fraises du Périgord. And we've got 7 varieties that are in the Appellation Contrôlée, and some of them, the Garriguette, come very early in the year, and the Clairon come much later in the year, the Lettre Jams. My favourites are the Marais des Bois, which are, they're developed from the Fraises du Bois, the woodland wild strawberries, little tiny, very sweet ones. And we make a strawberry wine. We get a pellet of strawberries and we pluck out the green and then crush them all with a fork and add in a little bit of sugar, just enough. And leave it in the fridge for most of the day. And so it just softens down and becomes almost liquid. And then we put a spoonful of that into the bottom of a tall wine glass, and we top it up with fizzy wine, with champagne, and a little stir, and it.
This is the wrong talk to have at lunchtime.
Well, Julia says, the only problem, Martin, with your novels is everyone means 2 extra pounds.
Yes. So, for the people who haven't read the book yet, what is The Body in the Castle Well all centred around? If you could just give us a snapshot about this book.
Okay, well, there's a young woman arrives in the Périgord, an American, young American woman, an art student, who has been spending some months at the Louvre. She's doing her doctorate in art history at the French Renaissance. And she comes down to the Périgord because one of the noted French experts, a man who recently retired from the Louvre, where he was their expert on the Renaissance, where he's retired, he's living in a small chateau. This man was crippled as a young resistance militant in World War II. And this young American woman goes to stay with him. She's from a very wealthy and very well-connected family. And so, I'm not giving much away. I said, when her body is found in the well of the chateau, then the White House, the American ambassador in Paris, and then the White House both get involved. And of course, Bruno gets involved and has to find out what happened. And was it an accident? Was she on, it seems that she was on opioid drugs, or was there something else behind it? And of course, there's a chap from the FBI comes down to help the searches. And then other things happen as well, as they always do in Bruno books. There's a wonderful castle, which I'm sure you know, Château de Milord, which is the Josephine Baker castle. Château de Milord is, there's a place on the Dordogne River where you have these two wonderful, classic medieval fortresses who sort of glower at one another across the river. Of course, one was held by the French and the other was held by the English, Baynac and Castelnau. And then just downriver from Castelnau is a much, much more attractive, much more elegant Renaissance chateau. And what happened was that the lord of Castelnau married a much younger wife. And you can just hear her saying to him, "Oh, darling, do we have to stay in this gloomy, stone-filled, old medieval fortress when those Italians are doing such wonderful things down there?" And so he built her this Château de Milord. And in the just before World War II, the great black American jazz singer, Josephine Baker, rented the place and then lived there. and it was there that she became a resistance heroine, smuggling stuff out to North Africa and Spain in her underwear. Wonderful woman, and I mean, not until I began researching it did I learn that when Martin Luther King shot, his wife, his widow, Coretta King, asked Josephine Baker to take over leadership of the civil rights movement, because she'd been there beside him when Martin Luther King gave the famous speech in Washington of We Shall Overcome, and Josephine Baker sang We Shall Overcome right there. And she said, no, I'm trying to raise this rainbow family of many children from different races. They must be my priority. But so I bring that in. And this Saturday Milan is also famous as a centre for hunting birds, falcons and gerfalcon peregrines and so on. They have displays of the birds hunting. So I bring in falconry as well into it all. I mean, it's like cooking. You bring in another ingredient, and in comes the vin de Loire, and
they're fantastic. So, thank you so much. It's been fascinating listening to it, but they're brilliant books as well. So, I'm sure we're all going to really enjoy, if they haven't already, dipping into The Body in the Castle Well, and also knowing that we've got another two lined up is great news. And you also write a blog, and there's Facebook pictures to look at. So do go on the internet as well to see all this wealth of information.
That I have a website, brunochiefofpolice.com, which is where I write the blog. But on that, there is a section called Bruno's Périgord, in which I published my own idea of the perfect week in the Périgord, with choices of hotels I know would like, and restaurants I know would like, and vineyards I particularly recommend. So,
if we're ever tempted away from Woodbridge. Anyway, we do need to close now, but there is the opportunity to have your book signed afterwards and chat a little bit more with Martin, but shall we just give him a bit of a round of applause?